KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We're demanding that the hiring freeze provide for a full and immediate exemption for VA personnel.
People who work with veterans are getting mixed messages this week about the government's hiring freeze.
For Thursday, January 23rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, what does it mean to designate drug cartels terrorist organizations?
Also, a January 6th insurrectionist who doesn't want a pardon.
And the internet has now spent 3 days debating whether Elon Musk made a Nazi salute.
The fact that we are discussing and debating it rather than calling it out, that is a net positive for them because they are trying to make their extreme ideology more mainstream.
Plus, women's soccer player Naomi Girma makes history.
Chelsea went out and said, who's one of the best players in the world that we can get right now, and how much do we need to be able to afford her?
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Another slew of executive actions signed today by President Donald Trump in the Oval Office. They range from orders aimed at making America the AI and crypto capital of the world, pardons for 23 anti-abortion protesters, and declassifying all files related to the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Trump also took questions on a variety of issues, including a Seattle judge's decision to block his order calling for an end to birthright citizenship.
Obviously, we'll appeal it. They put it before a certain judge in Seattle, I guess, right? And there's no surprises with that judge.
Trump expressed confidence about Pete Hegseth's nomination to be his Secretary of Defense, and he said tariffs are being discussed against China, but with no firm date set, unlike Canada and Mexico. California Governor Gavin Newsom has approved new disaster relief for victims of the fires in Los Angeles. From member station KQED, Guy Maserati says Newsom is hoping to meet with President Trump and collaborate on fire response.
Newsom signed a $2.5 billion relief package that will fund cleanup and sheltering those affected by the fires. But the governor also wants to spend more money to fight the Trump administration in court over issues like immigration.
I'm here for the long haul to support the president where we can, to defend our values where we must.
Trump has threatened to withhold disaster aid from California over disagreements on water policy. For NPR News, I'm Guy Maserati in San Jose.
The European Union got more electricity from solar power than coal last year. NPR's Jeff Brady reports coal continues its long decline in the EU, even as the industry in the U.S. is hoping for a boost from the Trump administration.
Nuclear remains the top source of electricity in the EU, followed by wind, gas, and hydropower. But a review of the European Union's electricity-generating fuels by the think tank Ember found for the first time solar generated more power than coal. Europe launched its Green Deal 5 years ago, aiming to zero out climate pollution by 2050. The U.S. has the same goal under the Paris Climate Agreement, though President Trump is withdrawing from that as he did during his first term. Renewable energy has also grown rapidly in the U.S. The research firm Rhodium Group says last year solar and wind power together generated slightly more electricity than coal in the U.S. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
More people were standing in line last week to file initial jobless claims. The Labor Department reporting today, claims for first-time unemployment benefits rose by 6,000 to 223,000 for the week ending January 18th. Total number of Americans receiving benefits climbed to 1.9 million. Weekly applications for jobless benefits are often considered to be a proxy for layoffs in the broader economy. Stocks closed higher on Wall Street, the Dow up 408 points today. You're listening to NPR. Speaking via videotape to participants at the Davos Economic Summit in Switzerland, President Donald Trump today promised cheaper prices and lower interest rates. He also pledged to lower taxes for global elites if they bring manufacturing jobs to the U.S. However, in an economy where growth has been driven by relatively healthy consumer spending, it's not entirely clear how Trump will carry out those pledges. Economists say if Trump follows through on promises to impose widespread tariffs and deport millions of migrants, inflation could worsen. Tina Turner's record label is releasing a previously lost song by the late rock icon. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Hot For You Baby isn't creating sparks among critics, but it's a welcome dose of nostalgia for her fans.
Hot For You Baby was originally destined for Tina Turner's blockbuster 1984 album Private Dancer, but it didn't make the cut. The song languished forgotten for roughly 40 years until Turner's record label rediscovered the master tape. Rolling Stone magazine contributing editor Anthony De Curtis says Hot For You Baby is a bit one-dimensional, not nearly as nuanced as tracks like What's Love Got To Do With It.
But, you know, it's got energy and it's got power and it's got excitement.
The critic says, most importantly, it makes us feel like Tina Turner, who died in 2023, is still with us. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
Some surprises from the Film Academy for this year's 97th Oscars. It had seemed that actors like Angelina Jolie and Nicole Kidman were destined for nominations, where the Academy members have snubbed some of the big names in favor of other actors like Felicity Jones and James Mangold. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. President Trump's nominee to lead the VA, Doug Collins, got a strong endorsement today from the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee with an 18-1 vote to confirm. His nomination now heads to the full Senate for a vote. But that wasn't the biggest news about the VA today. It's been a confusing time at the department since President Trump announced a federal hiring freeze Monday. The order said it would not affect veterans' benefits, but within 24 hours, doctors and nurses were getting VA job offers rescinded. NPR Veterans correspondent Quill Lawrence is here. Hi, Quill.
Hey, Ari.
Okay, so Doug Collins, Air Force colonel and former Georgia congressman, he was pressed about this federal hiring freeze at his confirmation hearing. What happened?
Yeah, in particular, the Democratic ranking member, Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, said that VA, where there's been an ongoing push to fill vacancies, needs a total exemption from this hiring freeze to get veterans timely health care and the benefits that they've earned. Collins respectfully pushed back.
No one on the veteran health care side is going to miss their health care provider because of this new hire freeze. The president is doing a prudent step as he comes into office to make sure that we have a good handle on what we've got and going forward.
But then just a day later, I started hearing stories from across the country about doctors, pharmacists, nurses, people who had already gone through a very complicated process to get hired by the VA, and they were having these job offers rescinded, like some of them after having moved and bought a house, you know, moved a U-Haul across the country. Suddenly they were told, no, you don't have a job.
Huh. Now, I understand 25 Democratic senators sent a letter to President Trump. You've seen this letter. What does it say?
Yeah, Senator Blumenthal led that effort, and he explained it to me earlier today.
There's no question that this hiring freeze will inhibit retaining and recruiting new people to serve our veterans where there are openings right now. So we're demanding that the hiring freeze provide for a full and immediate exemption for VA personnel.
So then, in the middle of speaking with Senator Blumenthal, this other VA memo came out, and the VA memo said that the VA was going to mostly do that. It exempts hundreds of thousands of VA health care jobs from the hiring freeze.
So where does that leave the doctors whose job offers got rescinded or the veterans themselves?
Yeah, well, so the memo directed that all of these jobs be reposted as openings and that the VA recontact the people who had, they had just rescinded the job offers from, these people who had what they thought were firm job offers that were canceled for about 48 hours. This memo acknowledged that that's going to take some time, and it certainly might have shaken some trust in the VA's job offers, hiring process. But there's still a few other issues. So, you know, these exemptions so far from the hiring freeze are almost all healthcare jobs. But that leaves out critical non-healthcare jobs like answering the veteran suicide crisis line, or, you know, all the people who are working through the backlog of veterans' disability claims. They don't appear to be included in this exemption from the hiring freeze. The Republican chair of the VA committee, Senator Jerry Moran, sent NPR a statement praising the VA's exemptions today and saying that VA needs to establish a clear long-term staffing plan.
Is anyone concerned that that phrase, clear long-term staffing plan, could be a euphemism for downsizing or cutting the VA?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's bipartisan agreement that if there's waste within the VA, it should be cut, making it work more efficiently. But Moran and many Republicans favor outsourcing a greater portion of VA care to the private sector. And they want vets to be able to choose either private care or VA care. They think that's the best way to get take care of veterans. But most studies show the VA doing as well or better than private care, and private care is very expensive. Some within the VA see this hiring freeze as just a very blunt tool to try and cut VA, and by doing that, push more veterans into getting care in the private sector.
And just briefly, another memo was sent to the VA and many other federal agencies apparently today, which appears to be a form letter telling federal staff to report on colleagues who may be trying to continue with diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts.
Yeah. VA, as you said, got what seems to be a pretty identical letter being sent across from acting directors saying that they are aware of efforts by some in government to disguise DEI programs by using coded or imprecise language, meaning that they're going to try and keep these DEI positions going despite Trump's order to end them. But the remarkable part is the letter said that staff should report immediately on anyone doing that, and there could be punishment for an employee that doesn't inform on their colleagues. And a lot of people told me that they just found that tone chilling.
That's NPR's Quill Lawrence, who covers veterans and the VA. Thanks a lot, Quill.
Thanks, Ari.
It is a fact that billionaire Elon Musk delivered a speech on Monday after President Trump's inauguration. It is also a fact that during that speech, Musk twice made a straight arm gesture. The debate over what he meant by that continues. As NPR's Shannon Bond reports, Musk benefits from the controversy, which he has now turned into a joke.
Elon Musk was less than a minute into his speech at the Capital One Arena on Monday when he thanked the crowd for their help electing President Trump.
And I just want to say thank you for making it happen. Thank you.
He then slapped his right hand over his heart and swung it out straight ahead, palm facing down. He turned around and repeated the motion.
My heart goes out to you. It is thanks to you that the future of civilization is assured.
What exactly Musk's gesture meant is still being debated. To many observers, it appeared to be a Nazi salute. Left-wing streamer Hassan Piker.
Did he just smile?
What?
CNN anchor Casey Hunt said viewers could judge for themselves what they saw.
It's not something that you typically see at American political rallies.
But others dismissed it as an awkward gesture, including the Anti-Defamation League, which calls itself a global leader in combating anti-Semitism and countering extremism. Right-wing influencer Dave Rubin said Musk was being smeared.
He did not make a Nazi salute. It's completely ridiculous.
Musk didn't respond to a request for comment. On Monday night, he called the uproar Democratic, quote, dirty tricks. Quote, the everyone is Hitler attack is so tired, he wrote on his platform X. But by Thursday morning, he had turned the incident into a joke, posting Nazi-themed puns to his more than 200 million followers.
And that tactic is designed to sort of keep pushing the norm of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, right? This sort of edgelord type of humor.
Shannon McGregor is a communications professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She says Musk is steeped in an internet culture that some on the right have long embraced.
Pushing the norms to the point where the idea is like nothing matters, right? And if nothing matters, then there are no norms.
Setting aside what Musk meant by the gesture, McGregor says he benefits from the fact that audiences of different political persuasions see the event totally differently.
This, what I would say, not necessarily unambiguous gesture, really has the hallmarks of what we call strategic ambiguity, which is something that's often employed by those on the right.
In the days following his speech, Musk slammed media coverage of the controversy. Quote, the legacy media is pure propaganda, he posted on X on Tuesday. He repeated a phrase he used right after President Trump's victory, telling X users, quote, "You are the media now."
If you're on the right, this is sort of the bona fides, right, of being attacked by the left, being attacked by the mainstream media, while at the same time normalizing something that is a really far-right gesture.
Andrew Torba, the founder of the far-right social platform Gab, praised Musk for the episode, posting that it, quote, "exposes the media's vulnerabilities, undermines their authority, and advances our agenda all at once." The debate over what Musk did and what he meant by it has energized far-right figures, including Torba, says Melissa Ryan, who tracks right-wing extremism in her newsletter Control Alt-Right Delete.
They're thrilled, right? They're thrilled that the attention is on them.
She considers Musk himself a far-right figure, citing his past posts sharing conspiracy theories and his recent endorsement of an anti-immigrant political party in Germany. She has no doubt the gesture was a Nazi salute, despite what Musk and his allies say.
The fact that we are discussing and debating it rather than calling it out, that is a net positive for them because they are trying to make their extreme ideology more mainstream.
And what was once considered unacceptable in public discourse is increasingly seen as normal. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
Naomi Girma and the English club Chelsea FC made history this week.
Girma is the star defender for the U.S. women's national soccer team. She's gripped the attention of fans worldwide. And this week, The Athletic reported that she would be leaving her team, San Diego FC, here in the U.S., to sign with Chelsea. That move is not just a big deal for Chelsea, which is getting one of the best defenders in the world.
Girma's transfer fee will be north of $1 million. It's the first time in history that a transfer fee for a women's soccer player has been that high.
Now, if you're not a soccer aficionado, a transfer fee is the money one team pays to another club to sign a player.
Chelsea went out and said, "Who's one of the best players in the world that we can get right now? And how much do we need to be able to afford her?" And it turns out the answer is over $1 million.
That's Meg Linehan, a senior writer for The Athletic. She says the high transfer fee for Girma is part of a broader trend of increased investment in women's soccer.
Now what we're seeing is there is this whole new group of ownership and investors and players even coming in who don't have this kind of scarcity mindset.
She says not only are teams spending more money to acquire players, investors are pouring more cash into women's soccer in general.
They're coming in and saying, "Well, why aren't we being ambitious? Why aren't we spending money? Why aren't we investing money?" And just going out and doing it.
For context here, last summer, over $6 billion were spent on transfer fees for male players compared to just $6 million for women players, according to The Athletic.
Linehan says that while the money spent on Girma's transfer is a good sign for parity between men and women soccer players, the next big step is advocating for higher salaries.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Since taking office on Monday, President Trump has signed a flurry of executive actions. Let's take a closer look at the order about designating drug cartels as terrorist organizations. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas is here. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Ryan, let's start with the executive order itself. What does it say?
So the order says that the cartels are a threat in a way that your kind of run-of-the-mill organized crime is not. These cartels use horrific violence to control illegal traffic of people and drugs across the southern border. And that, the order says, is a national security threat for the United States. What this order does is instruct the State Department to recommend within 14 days whether to apply this designation to the cartels, as well as two Central American criminal gangs. This sort of designation is something that has been considered in the past during Trump's first term in office, but also way back during the Obama presidency. Ultimately, the decision back then was not to move forward with it, though.
Got it. Okay, so on a practical level, what would designating the cartels as terrorist organizations actually do?
Well, first off, to be absolutely clear, the U.S. government already has the ability to go after drug traffickers and cartels with both prosecutions and sanctions. What the terrorism designation would do is kind of broaden those options a bit. And the most significant change, many experts say, would be the possibility to bring what's known as material support prosecutions. So under federal law, it is a crime to provide material support to designated terrorists. And material support can mean anything from money or weapons to lodging, false papers, even something just like a phone card. This is a bread and butter charge in terrorism prosecutions. And over the years, it has been interpreted pretty broadly.
In the context of supporting a cartel, who could face those kinds of charges?
Well, a whole range of folks. Members of the cartels, of course, street gangs in the U.S. that are selling the cartels' drugs, but also people who provide financial or logistical support to the cartels. The ripple effects, though, could be bigger. Some analysts point out that U.S. companies that do business in Mexico make payments to a Mexican company, potentially that is secretly controlled or affiliated with the cartel. They could face penalties. There's also migrants. Migrants could also potentially face material support charges because migrants often pay smugglers to get through Mexico or across the border, smugglers who in many cases have ties to the cartels. And that, in turn, could provide grounds for the U.S. government to keep those migrants out of the U.S.
So here's a question I've got. Could a terrorism designation pave the way for potential U.S. military action against these cartels?
Certainly heard about that concern. What I would say in response is that the president already has the authority to conduct military action. This designation wouldn't change that. It could, and I have to underline there, could provide political cover of a sorts. But look, unilateral military action on Mexican soil would be a huge step and something that Mexico has made quite clear that it would oppose.
Now, you mentioned that the U.S. has previously considered designating cartels as terrorist groups, but ultimately decided not to. Tell us why that is and what has changed.
So I talked about that with Jason Blazekas. He used to lead the State Department office that makes these designations. And he said that arguably the most significant reason it hasn't been done in the past is the negative impact that it would have on U.S.-Mexico relations. It could alienate Mexico. Of course, the U.S. needs to work with Mexico on migration, cartels, trade. As for what has changed, the most obvious thing is Trump is back in office. And he, of course, promised a swift and decisive action on the border, on migration, on drugs. There's clearly a political messaging angle to Trump's talk of designating cartels. This is a show of resolve. But this could also be a means to pressure Mexico to coordinate more with the U.S. on the cartel question, but also on those other thorny issues as well.
That is NPR's Ryan Lucas. Thank you.
Thank you.
In coastal Northern California, a group of volunteers spends every night from late fall through winter as crossing guards. Not for children, they are escorting migrating salamanders across a rural road. Their goal is to win a permanent safe passage for these little amphibians. Reporter Stephanie O'Neill has the story.
Sally Gale is a Marin County rancher who's helped save thousands of Pacific newts, a type of salamander that, herpetologically speaking, is awfully cute. Snout to tail, they're about 6 to 8 inches long. They're a rich reddish brown on top with a bright orange underbelly. And, says Gale,
they have cute little eyes that kind of bug out. They kind of look like a cartoon character.
But newts are slow movers, and for this otherwise healthy population of them here in Marin County's Chileno Valley, about 50 miles north of San Francisco, that spells trouble. Starting in late fall each year, these nocturnal migrators must cross a public road that divides their forested hillside habitat from their spawning ground at a nearby shallow lake. And at night, when pickup trucks and cars come zipping along this mile-long stretch of the road, many of the newts get squashed. For Gale, whose ranch is a couple miles away from the lake, seeing so many dead newts on the road was just too much.
And that's really what got me started. I couldn't stand seeing all those dead animals.
So 6 years ago, with help from a close friend, she launched the Chileno Valley Newt Brigade.
How's it going, people?
I think three adults, two babies.
Now about 80 strong, the grassroots group has to date carried to safety more than 22,000 Pacific newts and a host of other nocturnal amphibians and reptiles.
So we have a radio. This is Christine. Over.
I have one, Christine. This is Sony. Over.
Suited up with walkie-talkies, high-powered flashlights, and wearing reflective vests to keep themselves safe from cars, the Brigadiers patrol the migratory mile, a team of about 10 assigned to each night of the week. Some trek solo, others work together, flashlights sweeping the ground in front of them as they search for and ferry to safety anything trying to crawl, wiggle, or hop across the road.
Yeah, I got like 18 on that end. I don't know what everybody else has got, but there's like...
On this night, baby newts that just a while ago were legless tadpoles with gills and fins leave the lake and head to the hills. They'll spend the next 5 years in the moist forest maturing before returning to spawn. And crossing in the opposite direction, adults heading to breed at the lake, like this hefty guy.
He's big.
He's big.
That chonk.
He's well fed.
Each rescue is documented with a photo and information about the newt the team uploads to the citizen science app iNaturalist. Gary Bucciarelli is a wildlife biologist with the University of California at Davis. He applauds the brigade's work and says humans can learn a lot from newts. Among their most notable superpowers, they can regenerate fully functional limbs, organs, and tissue whenever injured.
And then also they live really long. A lot of people don't know this, but these newts can live 20, 30 years easily.
And perhaps much longer, Bucciarelli says, especially if they don't get mowed down.
Oh, was it an adult?
Yeah. Oh, so sad.
But not every casualty leads to death. Because of those regenerative abilities and the newt brigade escort, another newt they find stunned in the road with a bloodied, mostly severed tail just may survive.
If it's just the tail, he can regenerate it.
You're right, Bubba.
So I'm going to go put him over there and we'll hope for that.
In addition to saving lives each night, the Brigadiers collect important data. Sony Yalian is the Sunday night brigade captain.
We GPS every one of them. So every single observation that we make on iNaturalist, we know the position of the newt.
And that data is helping inform a study the newt brigade has commissioned, with financial help from a state grant, to examine road modifications that may one day provide the newts and other small creatures safe migratory passage. But until then, Sally Gale says, the Chileno Valley Newt Brigade will be there to ferry newts, frogs, toads, and turtles safely across the road.
Hello. Over.
Anything happening back there?
For NPR News, I'm Stephanie O'Neill in Marin County, California.
This is NPR News.
How does one of the 1,500 people convicted in the attack on the U.S. Capitol view his release from prison?
And as far as vindication goes, I've never looked for vindication or anything like that. This is just relief.
So would he do the same thing all over again? After the pardons, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News. We'll be right back.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. What brings together space radiation?
Vegan cheese.
And chimp urination?
I noticed that they seem to have a tendency to urinate around the same time.
It's the Science News Roundup from Shortwave, of course.
But first, these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. A federal judge in Seattle has temporarily blocked a Trump administration order curtailing what's known as birthright citizenship. NPR's Martin Costi says the judge called Trump's order blatantly unconstitutional.
The 14th Amendment grants citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil. But on Monday, President Trump signed an order withholding citizenship from children born to mothers who are in the country illegally or on temporary visas. Several states immediately sued, and a federal judge has now ordered the administration to hold off changing the citizenship rules. Washington State Attorney General Nick Brown welcomed the move.
We're back to the status quo. We're back to the rule that has been the law of this land now for generations, that you are an American if you were born in the United States.
But this is just a two-week pause as the states and the Justice Department prepare for the next steps in lawsuits over birthright citizenship. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
President Trump addressed the Economic Forum in Switzerland today with a focus on tariffs. Trump spoke from the White House by video to the annual gathering of political and business leaders. After listing what he sees as accomplishments in his first week in office, Trump told the crowd that the U.S. will slap a tax or tariff on goods imported from other countries.
If you don't make your product in America, which is your prerogative, then very simply you will have to pay a tariff. Differing amounts, but a tariff which will direct hundreds of billions of dollars and even trillions of dollars into our treasury to strengthen our economy and pay down debt.
Economists have said increasing tariffs on imported goods could hurt American consumers as well. Trump also called on Saudi Arabia to bring down the price of oil, saying that would end the Russia-Ukraine war because he says Russia has been using the profits to wage war. This is NPR. Americans who have applied for gender-neutral passports may have to reapply. The Trump administration has frozen all such applications, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
The State Department started issuing passports with male, female, or X markings in 2022 and said at the time that applicants could self-select their gender. But this week, President Trump issued an executive order banning that, saying the federal government's policy is that there are only two sexes, male and female. According to The Guardian, Secretary of State Marco Rubio followed up, telling his staff to suspend any applications from Americans seeking to change their sex marker or requesting an X on their passport. The order is not retroactive. Current gender-neutral passports remain valid, though Americans who have them may have difficulties when they renew. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A cold snap that's gripping large portions of the country this week from the north to the south has had some chilling effects, from extreme wind chills in the Midwest to record-breaking rare snow in the deep south. New York City's rat czar, Kathleen Corradi, says the frigid temperatures have also chilled the Big Apple's rodent population. She says the city is now redoubling its efforts to get rid of them. On Wall Street, stocks finished higher today. You're listening to NPR.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. More than 1,500 people who participated in the January 6th assault on the Capitol 4 years ago got a pardon from President Trump this week. Our next guest turned down the offer of clemency. Pamela Hemphill is 71 years old. She served 60 days in jail on a misdemeanor charge for her role in the insurrection. And when President Trump posted on social media in June of 2023 that her sentence was horrible, she replied, "I'm not a victim of Jan 6. I pleaded guilty because I was guilty." Pamela Hemphill joins us from Boise, Idaho. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me.
You pleaded guilty to a single misdemeanor charge of parading, demonstrating, or picketing in the Capitol building. Why did you not want a pardon from President Trump?
Oh, well, you know, it would be a slap in the face to the Capitol police officers, to the rule of law, to our whole nation. I would be contributing to their false propaganda that they continue to gaslight the nation and everyone that it was a peaceful protest. You know, I broke the law that day, period, black and white. I'm not a victim, I'm a volunteer. And I don't want to be a part of them trying to rewrite history, what really happened that day. So if I took a pardon, I'm saying, yeah, it's okay what I did that day. No, it was not okay.
Do you think anyone should be pardoned for their actions on January 6th?
No, not one. I've studied a lot of these cases. No, not at all.
Was it difficult for you to come to terms with the idea that the image you had on January 6th, 2021 was wrong?
Oh, yes. It's like, how was I so naive? Well, I see now how I was, because it's a cult and you get gaslighted and they lie to you and say there's this deep state and the DOJ is against Trump and all this garbage. And you know, you're listening to people with two PhDs. You don't question them. And then Giuliani, you know, he was a hero in New York. I mean, why would you question them? Why would you think they're lying?
You've clearly gone from one extreme to the other. Do you find that you are still able to have conversations with people who marched alongside you on the day of the insurrection? Are you able to talk to people on their terms and reach any kind of a common understanding, or are you just speaking different languages at this point?
Oh, different languages. Oh, no. No matter what you say, they usually can't handle it and they'll walk away. If I say, hey, let's sit down, let me show you something that you haven't heard, listen to this side of the story. Because, you know, that's why we have divorce courts, because there's always two sides of a story, right? I want to hear both sides. They don't. They do not want to hear anything that goes up against Trump. And that's what's so dangerous right now. No critical thinking.
And so what's this moment like for you when you served your time behind bars? You had the exchange on social media that went viral. You got attention as the person who people referred to as the MAGA granny. And then you were kind of living your life until this moment that all of these pardons came down and you said, no, thank you.
It's been horrible, the attacks and what I've had to go through to keep my voice out there, because this is my amends to change the narrative of January 6th. It's so important that people have the facts. They do not give you the truth. They give you propaganda that can be debunked by researchers, court records. So their narrative is all for Trump, because Trump is a criminal. He broke the law. He has to keep this narrative going that the DOJ is weaponized against him and his followers. And we know that is not true. There's been enough evidence to prove that.
Pamela Hemphill, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much, sir.
And we want to remind you that President Trump was found guilty of falsifying business records before he took office. He was given an unconditional discharge, which means he did not have to serve jail time, but the conviction stays on his record.
Tina Turner fans got a special gift today. The late rock star's producers have unearthed the song the public has never heard. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports Hot For You Baby was originally destined for Turner's blockbuster 1984 album, Private Dancer.
The competition for a place in the lineup on Private Dancer was stiff. Between gutsy anthems like What's Love Got To Do With It and sultry ballads like the album's title track, Private Dancer.
I'm your private dancer, a dancer for money. Do what you want me to do.
Hot For You Baby just didn't create enough heat.
How hot can you get? Yeah, hot for you, baby.
A song which essentially expresses one idea, Hot For You Baby, was kind of monochromatic for her.
That's Rolling Stone magazine contributing editor Anthony De Curtis.
And the rest of the stuff that's on Private Dancer is much more nuanced.
That album became a huge commercial success. It established Turner as a bona fide solo star after a long slump following her breakup with her former musical collaborator and husband Ike Turner. She went on to score huge hits like We Don't Need Another Hero and The Best.
You're simply
Meanwhile, Hot For You Baby languished forgotten. A BBC report says Turner's record label recently rediscovered the master tape while putting together a 40th anniversary re-release of Private Dancer. NPR Music and pop culture happy hour host Stephen Thompson says it's all about cultivating nostalgia for the artist who died in 2023.
People miss Tina Turner. Tina Turner put out all this amazing music and she was this wonderful force.
Pop music history is riddled with posthumous song rediscoveries. Thompson says the year after Prince died in 2016, the artist's label started re-releasing a bunch of previously unheard songs recorded in 2006, starting with this one.
After an artist died, now that their commercial output has been capped and cauterized, there's this sense of like, give me something that I missed, and it'll be like I'm communing with the dead.
Thompson says Tina Turner's Hot For You Baby isn't very good, but these musical curiosities are understandably widely embraced. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You might have been hearing today about the artists nominated for Oscars, but we don't only want to talk about those who are nominated, let's also talk about those who aren't. You might remember the outcry when the critical and audience darling Barbie missed out on Best Director and Best Actress nominations last year.
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Ken!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Hi, Barbie!
Seems that every year, moviegoers find ways the Academy has blown it. Tomorrow afternoon, NPR producer Mark Rivers and movie critic Bob Mondello weigh in on some of the times Oscar ignored films and actors that maybe they shouldn't have.
Almost always there's a good reason. Actually, let me rephrase that. There's a dumb reason that makes no sense, but that makes sense to the Academy somehow.
We talk biggest Oscar blunders tomorrow on All Things Considered.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has picked a conservative critic of mainstream media to lead the U.S. Agency for Global Media. That is the parent agency of federally owned international broadcasters like Voice of America. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has chronicled the agency and joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Juana.
So, David, let's just start with the news if we can. Who has Trump picked to run the U.S. Agency for Global Media?
So he's picked a 69-year-old kind of firebrand conservative media critic named Brent Bozell. He's the founder of Media Research Center, which has really been a fixture on the right, holding the media to account, the mainstream news media in particular, for being what he perceives as reflexively liberal and in kind of thrall to the Democratic Party. He'd been really a figure that you can see particularly on conservative talk radio, Fox News, and other sympathetic outlets to that point of view.
Many people are familiar with him, of course, but tell us why Trump chose him.
Well, Trump said that on Truth Social and posting about it that he was just the right guy to bring change. And he mentioned Bozell's family. Bozell has links. His uncle was the founder of the National Review, William F. Buckley. Buckley wrote with Bozell's father at least one book, and I think collaborated on other things as well. Interestingly, his son was convicted of assaulting law enforcement officers in the January 2021 siege of the Capitol, but his son was released after being encompassed in the near blanket pardons that Trump recently issued for all of that. And Bozell, you know, Trump has indicated he wants Bozell to be accompanied by Carrie Lake to be the director of Voice of America. Lake, of course, a former Arizona a local newscaster who ended up running for statewide office in Arizona unsuccessfully twice as a very strongly pro-Trump candidate, and indeed has made a part of her appeal, her attacking the press as being fake news.
This is a position that must be confirmed by the Senate. So if Brent Bozell is confirmed, what changes could be ahead for this agency?
Well, he hasn't announced particulars yet, but I think it's instructive to look back at what Trump was able to do in his final year in office. He finally, after a two-year wait, got appointed a conservative documentarian named Michael Pack, who kind of turned the place upside down, both trying to more politicize the institution, but also to really crack down on what he saw was the swamp of fake news. And so you had things like senior executives accused of being part of security breaches, but particularly you had political appointees reaching down and conducting what they considered were reviews for anti-Trump bias. Others called it a kind of politicized witch hunt, looking for people who saw themselves as straight reporters somehow being biased against President Trump for simply reporting the news. And one thing I want to mention is the Voice of America and its sister networks like Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, and others are supposed to model democracy by having the inclusion of dissent in their news coverage and criticisms of whoever's in office at that time, and also to bring independent news reporting into lands where there aren't independent news outlets. And what you saw under PAC in those 7.5 months under Trump was really an effort to promote a Trump vision of the world. And we'll see what Bozell would bring to the agency if he's confirmed.
That's NPR's David Folkenflik. Thank you so much.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. It's time for our science news roundup from Shortwave, NPR Science Podcast. And we're joined in the studio today by Regina Barber and Jonathan Lambert. So nice to see your smiling faces.
Hey.
Hello.
You've brought us three science stories that caught your attention from this week. What are they?
Contagious peen among chimps.
I'm sorry, what?
Yep.
Finding a chorus of waves in space.
Lovely.
And new ways to make plant-based cheese.
Yum. Let's start with contagious peeing among chimps. Sorry, it's NPR. We should say urination. Contagious
yes.
urination. What is going on?
Yeah, okay. So to put this in context, have you ever heard of contagious yawning?
Yeah,
like if
totally.
I yawn, you mm-hmm. get the urge to yawn too?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm holding back the yawn right now. So Ina Onishi, a grad student at Kyoto University in Japan, was studying a group of captive chimpanzees when something similar struck her as odd.
I noticed that they seem to have a tendency to urinate around the same time. And it kind of reminded me of some human behaviors of going to the bathroom together, for example.
So like the same effect is making chimps pee together that makes us yawn in sequence?
Yeah. So this observation got Ina wondering if this behavior might be socially contagious, like yawning. And to see if it was, she spent more than 600 hours watching a group of 20 chimpanzees.
To see when they pee? She had to track every time one of them relieved themselves?
Yeah, and she said that it was easier to hear them pee than to see them pee. But so she noted when each individual chimp peed and where they were relative to each other. And looking at the data altogether, an interesting pattern emerged.
So basically, chimps were peeing together a bit more often than you'd expect if they were just peeing at random. And she published that conclusion in the journal Current Biology this week.
Could she tell why this was happening?
So being closer helped, but proximity wasn't like the main factor here. Chimps have a hierarchical society, and it turns out that the lower ranking chimps were more likely to catch the urge to pee from more dominant chimps.
So when my boss pees, I'm going to pee?
Yeah.
Is that what you're telling
maybe,
me?
Maybe. And they don't know why this is. It could just be that lower ranking chimps are paying closer attention to higher ranking ones. But that's just one possibility.
Okay, so there's clearly more to study here. But is there any evolutionary reason that contagious urination would be an advantage?
One idea is that doing the same thing together just kind of helps a group sync up, which could help them operate better as a unit. If this happens in the wild, it might help the chimps avoid predators who get attracted by the smell of pee by concentrating it all in one spot.
But we can't rule out that there might be like a non-adaptive reason. It could be just that the chimps pee when they hear other chimps pee, sort of like humans get the urge when you hear like running water.
Okay, let's move on from that one. Tell me about our second story, a chorus in space.
Yeah, so there are these things called chorus waves. Do you want to hear?
Of course I do.
Yeah. It's cool, right?
I feel like I'm in a jungle listening Whoa. To the dawn chorus.
Yeah, it's an audio clip, and it's been reconstructed from radiation coming 100,000 miles above Earth's surface.
That's about 165,000 kilometers. It's a natural phenomenon thought to be created from bunched-up electrons trapped in Earth's magnetic field. And what's interesting is that these waves have been studied for almost 70 years, but Earth's chorus waves have never been found that far out until this recent study published in Nature.
But the surprising thing is they actually observe it and they see these waves in this region, which is kind of unexpected. It changes our ideas a little bit.
So that's Richard Horn, a professor and distinguished research scientist at the British Antarctic Survey on space weather. He wasn't part of the study, but he said the study might change how scientists think chorus waves are created.
How so?
Well, the leading hypothesis on how chorus waves are created suggests that gradients in the Earth's magnetic field are very important, and that as chorus waves grow, they should cause bunching of electrons.
But here's the complication. This study, for the first time, found chorus waves further out, where Earth's magnetic field is much weaker and non-uniform. And yet the waves were growing, and the electrons were still bunched, so the magnetic field gradient did not seem to be that important.
I'm sure Brian Eno is going to make a record with these waves any day now, but if I'm not Brian Eno, why should I care about this?
Right. I mean, legit question. Electrons create these waves, and then the waves themselves affect the electrons. It's like a feedback loop. Chorus waves can actually, like, push these electrons to move nearly the speed of light.
And these extremely fast particles can disrupt electrical components that are aboard so many communication satellites and can damage spacecraft, too. So understanding how chorus waves are created is important to our everyday lives.
Hmm. Okay, shall we make another really hard pivot from chorus waves in space to vegan cheese? What's up with the vegan cheese?
Yeah, so I'm lactose intolerant. I'm not a fan of vegan cheese, but I'm like excited for possible better vegan cheese in the future. So my question to you, have you tried it?
Oh, I spend a lot of time with vegans. I've absolutely tried vegan cheese. I think they do better at like the ultra processed Velveeta type stuff than they do at like the artisanal aged cheddar.
Of course. Mm.
Well, regardless of how you two feel, it definitely fills a niche. But many of these cheese alternatives you can buy in stores are also lower in protein than dairy cheese and use a lot of starch. And they often just don't melt and stretch like real cheese.
So this is going to sound like the setup to a joke, but how do you make better vegan cheese?
Science, Ari. So Stacey Dobson is a PhD candidate at the University of Guelph in Ontario, and she and a research team developed this new cheese formulation and told us that the team's first step was to get a better understanding on how the proteins, starches, and fats were like all working together. They looked at a bunch of proteins, including lentils and fava beans and pea protein, and they tested those with different fats.
Specifically, a lot of plant-based cheeses in stores use coconut oil, but researchers found if they blended coconut oil with sunflower oil, their cheese melted and stretched even more like dairy cheese.
Ooh. You gotta have that melty stretch in a grilled cheese sandwich.
Yes, and Stacey says that the team also put these combinations into a machine that's kind of like a CT scan, but for food. So it lets the researchers look at the inside of the structures, things like how big the fat globs were inside each version of the cheese.
So for example, Stacey saw that big oil globules kind of spread out more in the mouth and could work well for things that need to be melty, like grilled cheese. They wrote all about it in the journal Physics of Fluids.
Dare I ask how it tasted?
Yeah, so she and her team said that they tried like lots of this cheese during the research process. They had this little pizza oven and toaster to test it all out, and she says,
if I made you a grilled cheese sandwich with it, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between that and dairy cheese.
Stacey said the team was working only on some aspects of these cheeses, and there's a lot of work the industry still needs to do to figure out even better ways to make them act and taste like dairy cheese.
That's Jonathan Lambert and Regina Barber from NPR Science Podcast Shortwave, which you can follow for new discoveries every day. Mysteries and the science behind the headlines. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZQIL, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZQIL.com. From Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from the public.
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you full of pep?
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you happy, happy?
Yes, yes, yes.
Are you full of stepper? What do you know, Gabe? Are you in the know or are you a solid bringer down? Listen here, Jack. Take it slow and you can learn just what I mean. Are you hep to the jive? Are you hep to the jive? Are you hep? Are you hep? Are you keeping in step? Are you hep to the jive? Do you lace your boots high? Are you fly or you fly? do you dig, do you dig, do you swing on a gig? How you have to the jive? Do you get in the groove?
Yes, yes.
Does the beat make you move?
Yes, yes.
Do you send yourself jacking and then trillion back again? Know that it's smooth.